Shrink Wrap Radio 299, Cronenberg's film A Dangerous Method, with Jungian analyst John Beebe.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today, after a long absence, is Dr. John Beebe, past president of the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco. To learn more about Dr. Beebe, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John Beebe, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here again.
Well, it's been 3 years since I had you on the show talking about the feminine in film, and then you were here once before. I'm blocking now on what that conversation was about. Oh, it was about typology.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's great to have you back on. I had a number of listeners asking about the Cronenberg film, A Dangerous Method, and I know you're a film buff, and I also know that you headed a panel this past weekend at the San Francisco Jung Institute in San Francisco on that very topic, which I had planned to attend but wasn't able to do so. So I'm really happy that I can tap into at least some of what I missed on Sunday.
Well, thank you. Yes, we did have a panel in which both analysts trained in the Jung Institute of San Francisco and an analyst from the psychoanalytic side talked about the film and different aspects of its history, its response, the way it was constructed. The aim of our job that day was to deconstruct A Dangerous Method, because for so many people, that construction becomes received as history itself, the way we often trust what we read or trust what we see. And that seems like a necessary work of analysis in itself to see what was constructed and why, and also to deconstruct it enough to know that it's one narrative truth or one narrative untruth with its own life and energy, and that has to be separated from whatever the actual truth was of these three remarkable people who were depicted in the film. Really four remarkable people if you add Otto Gross.
Yes, and I want to be sure to get around to asking you about him as well. I totally agree with you. Even somebody who's, you know, relatively familiar with some of the historical information about the figures in the film, Freud and Jung, at least, I left the film scratching my head and wondering, you know, well, I wonder about the historical accuracy here. There were, you know, quite a few things to wonder about. So I'm really glad that that we have you here and that the panel spent some time looking into it. And I know you actually did some research. You weren't just doing it off the top of your head. So let's talk about the historical accuracy of the film. And we might as well get the sexual part out of the way first, because that's the thing that really smacks people in the face right off.
It's interesting that you say smacks people in the face. I forgive me for hearing you analytically. Not only sex that is imputed to Jung and Spielrein. And by the way, if I say Spielrein, it's because I'm American. The actual way to pronounce her name is Spielrein. But since we're not in Swiss Germany today, and I will sometimes simply say Spielrein, I'll try to remember Spielrein, but I'm avoiding the question, aren't I? Let's
yes.
say that the film speaks of, shows a developing erotic and then transference and then countertransference between Jung's first psychoanalytic patient, Sabina Spielrein, who he began treating with psychoanalytic methods that he'd read about sometime in the latter part of 1904, continuing till the end of her hospitalization for what then would have been called hysteria with psychotic features, at the Burkholz-Lee Clinic, the most enlightened psychiatric hospital in Europe, where she stayed for approximately 10 months under Jung's care and emerged well enough to resume her ambition to become a medical doctor, which she did go on to do, and eventually, and interestingly enough, a Freudian psychoanalyst who eventually took psychoanalysis to Russia and was probably the most important early pioneer of psychoanalysis in Russia. So that's the brief story of her treatment.
There are some interesting points in there that you made that I want to call out. The first being that she was Jung's first analytic patient, and secondly, that he got it based on reading. He had not actually met Freud yet. He had not been analyzed himself, etc. So those are two very, very interesting points. And also, we should mention that the Burkholz-Lee Clinic, as I understand it, was actually a, I can't think of the right word, but it was related to the University of Zurich. It was their clinic.
It certainly, there was some kind of definite relationship between the two, although they were in a way separate institutions. There was a relationship between the two. And psychiatry at the Burkholz-Lee had a great deal of academic respectability and quite a lot of reputation, as Zurich did generally, for being more liberal and more enlightened than most places in Europe at the time. For instance, the very fact that Sabina Spielrein was even in Zurich was that the University of Zurich was willing to take not only women medical students, but Jewish women medical students who were essentially, that was essentially unheard of in Russia. In Russia, if you were Jewish, it was extremely hard to get into medical school at all. And if you were a Jewish woman, there was no hope. So a number of Jewish people came to Zurich, especially to continue their education. And Sabina was one of this group of Jewish women. In fact, another became the wife of the first president of Israel, Weizmann. And Weizmann describes what the Jewish women from Russia were like, and he said they were far more attractive, better educated, and carried themselves altogether better than any of the other Jewish women that were in Zurich to study. And he liked them enormously and married one of them. So you could see her coming, this group of people.
Well, there's a new piece of info in here for me. Are you saying that she was already in Zurich as a student? I was under the impression that she had been brought to the clinic from Russia because of her extreme symptoms.
Well, that's, of course, one of the constructions that I think the film allows you to think, mm-hmm. that this was a complete mess of a woman who had the family in despair, chose out the, because the father had money, the family chose out the best place in Europe for her to get psychiatric treatment. Thanks to the miraculous work that Dr. Jung did by listening to her and the value of the psychoanalytic method, suddenly she emerges like Athena from the head of Zeus, able to know what she wants to do, and she wants to become a medical doctor and a psychiatrist. In fact, she wanted to be a medical doctor from childhood on, mm-hmm. and when she recovered, she resumed her original plan, which was to engage in these studies. It's certainly true that she broke down with hysterical symptoms, using the term that were used then for that condition, in the course of trying to pursue medical studies, and therefore had to start up again and apply, and even for a period of time use the Burkholz-Lee as her address while she was going to the university, which took some doing on the part of not only of Jung, but his chief broiler. But the energy to become a doctor came from Sabina. It did not come from an identification with Jung or from any part of her treatment. It was something she already wished to do.
Well, you know, this sounds, now it sounds like a very contemporary story, because I think of university students who, you know, having worked in a university counseling center, university clinics over the years myself, there's a certain number of students that in the course of their studies experience some kind of a psychological breakdown or distress, and they go to the university clinic and they get some treatment, and some are usually they're able to continue their studies while they're being treated. So this actually has some features that make it sound a lot more contemporary.
Right. But as to what happened between her and Jung, which of course is where the movie centers, psychoanalytic treatment in those days was usually undertaken by Freud and everyone else for only a relatively brief period with the patient. So though the sessions were quite frequent, sometimes as frequent as literally every day, and it was considered so important that the patient be seeing the analyst regularly so that defenses could not solidify and so that the psyche stayed open to the psychoanalytic intervention, that if the analyst went on a vacation, the patient went on the vacation with that analyst family, stayed in the same or a nearby hotel so they could continue the sessions even during that. Erik Erikson, for instance, went on vacation with Freud and his family so that he could continue. But all of this was possible because the analytic experience was relatively short. It was almost always less than a year. A frequent length of the early analyses was about 6 months. So it was not expected that one would be a patient forever and be exploring the way people do nowadays, sometimes for decades. It just wasn't the same thing at all. So the treatment of Sabina Spielrein did take place in about 10 months, and she was discharged from the Burgholzli, not labeled cured, but definitely labeled improved. And there really was not a plan for outpatient follow-up in individual psychotherapy. That really didn't exist. So what Jung chose to do was continue to see her because he was so important to her as a kind of friend. And so they would meet and she would have a relationship with him of some kind that she found to be very important. For the longest time, this involved Jung's listening to her desires to not to marry him, not to cause him to divorce Emma Jung, but to somehow have some kind of love affair with him, and especially to conceive a child, which she would call Siegfried. So Jung allowed this to go on, and we do not know exactly what happened. All we have is a diary that was found many years later in the 1970s in the archives of a leading psychologist of the day named Claparède, who had once a reputation and now is forgotten. In his archives, there was Sabina Spielrein's diary, which got published first in Italian and then in English in 1980. And she talks about how she and Jung engaged in poetry. And this seems to have involved hand-holding, exchange of feelings, probably some kissing, although it's a little unclear even as to that, but to this day, no one knows if it progressed all the way to frank sexual intercourse. Jung denied that that had happened to Freud, but it is clear that he certainly allowed what today would be called clearly a boundary violation as part of his whole keeping this relationship that was so important to her alive. And at some point, someone sent an anonymous letter to Sabina Spielrein's mother saying that this relationship is really getting out of hand, and the mother wrote back to Jung. Now, that's in the film, but what's not in the film is the backstory. which was that all along, Sabina was describing the poetry that was taking place between her and Jung in letters to her mother, who had written back saying, you've got the ideal situation here. You have a man who's married, who doesn't want to leave his wife, who's willing to allow you a friendship and be tender with you to a certain degree, and this is a good, this is a wonderful thing. You have the best of both worlds, and I see this as a great advantage to you. It was only when the anonymous letter came that the mother had to write to Jung, partly because the father would be involved now, and the father that Sabina was dealing with was an extremely intrusive father who had hysterical rages of his own, and there would be the danger that he would threaten to take her out of medical school, that he would come and interfere with her life. So it forced Jung and Sabina to realize, look, this can't go as far as it seems to be going. Most people think, as I think Jung and Sabina believed at the time, that the anonymous letter was written by none other than Emma Jung, who was beginning to feel that this relationship with the patient could be a threat to the marriage. So we have to read between the lines as to what happened. But I would point out that the psychoanalyst V. Lothain, who's written three articles on this and has an article in the book on Sabina Spielrein, says by Covington and Wharton, which has most of the documents, including Sabina's hospital record, which and a lot of other things, so that we have the fullest documentation there. In that book, V. Lothain says that he believes that there was no sexual relationship between Jung and Sabina, but there certainly was quite a lot of exchange of feelings, and Jung, at the very least, allowed Sabina to believe that he was in love with her, too.
Cronenberg really went quite far when he portrays in the film, it really centers around a sadomasochistic, so very explicit sadomasochistic sexual relationship. That is pretty much total fabrication.
Yes. And Cronenberg has admitted that this is his own elaboration onto the original play by Christopher Hampton, which had the title The Talking Cure and was produced in London in 2002 with Ralph Fiennes in the role of C.G. Jung on the stage. In Hampton's original play, there is the erotic relationship, but there is not any sexual thanking, which is what's shown, a kind of Sabina asks Jung in the film to spank her. She wants this experience. He eventually reluctantly gives in, and then later, in the most passion the Jung in the film ever really shows, he seems to give her a good whack and finally be into it. And there's some way in which one is made to feel that Jung himself comes alive a little bit in the course of finally submitting to this, although it's something that is so charged and so secret, so private, and would be so humiliating for anyone else to know, that you see that it's like many passions depicted in films as different as Dr. Zhivago and Blue Velvet, as something that really is too private and too shameful to be shared, but deeply exciting. But all of this is Cronenberg's attribution. This fits into Cronenberg's kind of film. And he has a long history of sadistic and sadomasochistic exchanges between characters in his films. This is a Cronenberg invention, and it makes it a Cronenberg film and a Cronenberg construction.
Uh-huh.
Movingly portrayed by the actor in a way that is very credible, and one is sort of happy to see this rather stiff, timid accountant that Jung is sort of made to seem, who simply takes the associations on the association test in a very quasi-scientific way, become something of a human being. So in a certain way, we see Sabina setting Jung free a little bit from his rigidity. But this is quite an American, and I shouldn't only say American, it's quite a Cronenbergian twist. It's a little to do with real psychoanalytic history.
Now, speaking of real psychoanalytic history, they actually mention the terms transference and countertransference in the film, but I was wondering if those concepts had been articulated yet at that point.
Well, certainly the term transference had been articulated, and it was understood that a psychoanalytic patient would develop a transference to the doctor. That was understood. That was almost from the beginning with the famous case of Anna O, which is a pseudonym for the first psychoanalytic patient of Breuer and Freud, that came out in studies in hysteria. So the idea of transference was certainly new. It was, in fact, on the basis of the Spielrein episode, which forced Jung to have to write to Freud and tell him that there was a scandal brewing around his supposed sexual relationship with a client, and Spielrein then saying Jung is covering up to some degree Professor Freud. There's been a little more here than meets the eye. So here's Freud with letters from both the analyst and the patient saying, your method has gotten us into emotional complications and we both need your help. It was on the basis of that, we believe, that Freud, as he often did after things happened, added an idea to his theory. And that idea was countertransference. On top of that, Jung made a suggestion to Freud, which has since been adopted by every training institute in the world, both Freudian and Jungian, that anyone who conducts a psychoanalysis has to be analyzed themselves. That was Jung's suggestion to Freud. And again, we believe that it was on the basis of the Spielrein affair, whatever that affair consisted of.
Well, speaking of ideas that came about as a result of this relationship, I thought that the film seemed to imply that Sabina was the source of some of the big ideas of analysis. For example, anima and animus, the hero archetype, among others, and even the notion of the death instinct.
Well, that's certainly the way the film presents it. And there, part of the construction builds on a kind of feminist reading of history, which is in turn compensating for the masculinist reading of history. As we know, most of the important power positions were held by men, especially at the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century. We were still in an extremely patriarchal period. I just mentioned how difficult it was for women to become medical doctors in that time. And so very often the scientific man is writing works and then the wife is giving him his best ideas, and her name doesn't even appear in the acknowledgments except as the person who washed the dishes. I mean, there's often a need to make sure that women's contributions are honored. It is absolutely true that the first paper in which anyone mentions anything like a death instinct, though I don't think that word is used in the paper as such, is Sabina Spielrein's paper, Destruction as a Cause of Coming into Being. She published this in the yearbook that Jung edited, and at that point we add another relationship between Jung and Sabina, And that's, this is in approximately, I remember correctly, 1912, that her paper is published. And Jung is the editor. And there is a dialogue, and she's worried that Jung may be taking ideas from her and that will go into his writings. But he absolutely gets her paper in print under her name. So she was able to publish this at the very beginning of the time when either Freud or Jung would be seeing anything positive or creative or leading forward in the psyche of aggression. She's able to publish this under her own name in the journal that Jung had asked for it to be the editor of. So in that sense, she's given full credit for her originality there. And Jung and Freud does refer to that paper in his writings a few times. And Jung himself cites her at some point. So it isn't as if she was left out. The problem is that psychoanalytic history moved on and didn't keep talking about her.
Yeah, I had never heard of her before the advent of this film.
But it's the case that she was just simply, her ideas were stolen and she wasn't given any credit. It's absolutely not true that she suggested the idea of the anima and the animus to Jung, nor was it clear what some people think, that because of his experience with Sabina Spielrein, it's on the basis of that that Jung got the anima idea. He does say somewhere in Memories, Dreams, Reflections that there was a woman who behaved differently from the way that he thought she would behave, and why the devil did he think she would behave differently? And then he began to think and said, well, I seem to have had a set of unconscious expectations as to how a woman is going to behave. Now, many people assumed that that woman was Sabina Spielrein. In fact, it's much more likely that the woman in question, who was the biggest problem for him at that time, was neither Sabina Spielrein nor a woman that Jung did have a relationship with that we know about that lasted for decades, Toni Wolff, not that woman, but a third woman named Maria Molzer, who was a Dutch woman who came to Zurich to study Jungian psychology. And we do know that Jung and she had both an affair and a falling out. And so it may have been that woman, and it seems to be that she's the woman that he had to break with, and it may well be the woman that made him start thinking about the anima animus, because it's around that time that he starts talking about that piece of the theory. So, yes, I'm sure his experience with Sabina Spielrein had some role, his experience with Toni Wolff, but it certainly is not the case that the theoretical idea came from Sabina Spielrein. There's nothing that suggests that at the level that the film just puts that theory into her mind. I don't think that's accurate.
What about Jung's relationship with Freud? How accurately was that portrayed?
Well, there Jung comes across as very crass. He goes to Freud's house, doesn't seem to even be situationally or socially aware enough to realize that there are, although there's a big plate of meat, there's something like 15 people at the table, an extended family, all of whom Freud has to feed, and Jung is taking so much of the meat that there's not going to be enough for other people, and he's just acting like the resources of the Freud household are endless. Then when he and Ferenczi and Freud are supposed to get on the Bremen, they arrive on the ship going to America to bring psychoanalysis to America at an event at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. In 1909, the one where the picture of everybody was taken. Jung is made to say that in a very crass, cheesy way, as the men are going to their rooms, my wife booked my rooms, and I'm in first class, which meant that they wouldn't be eating together. And he was throwing his wealth and privilege in their face and making them feel like second class citizens, which particularly as Jewish doctors, they already were sensitive to. So Jung comes across as both a boor and a snob. The reality is that Freud got the invitation to go to Clark University quite a long time before Jung did. So Jung got the invitation to go to Clark University much later than Freud, and by then all of the seats in second class were sold out. So Jung writes to someone that he's very concerned that he's going to have to go first class while Freud is going second class. And at the symposium, I heard Tom Kirsch say something I haven't myself laid eyes on, that there's actually a letter from Jung to Freud on that point, that explaining that Jung's wife did make the reservation, but that she was unable to get a seat in the same class as Freud because they were all sold out. So that unfortunately, he's going to have to take a first class seat. So far from being insensitive to the issue, the record shows that Jung was very sensitive to the issue. So that would be another example of building the Jung myth, which these days includes Jung the boor, Jung the snob, Jung the anti-Semite, the mad Jung, Jung the serial seducer of his patients, and a womanizer his entire life, and Jung who married Emma Jung simply for her money. Those are all the myths, and I think every single one of them can be proved to be quite untrue, especially in the way they've been constructed.
Interesting. And another aspect of what you've just said is the film portrays Freud as very sensitive to Jung's greater wealth and the fact that he was not Jewish. Was that a construction?
Well, first of all, Freud was very, very excited to have Jung in the psychoanalytic movement for two reasons, and he says so in his correspondence, which was voluminous and documents what he did feel at the time and how his feelings about Jung changed over time. First of all, Freud was very sensitive about being Jewish. He was very aware of the anti-Semitism in Austria. He was bitter about the fact that it was extremely difficult for him to get a university professorship just simply because he was a Jew. And he was particularly worried, as he put it, that psychoanalysis, and I'm going to quote Freud from memory, but it would become a national Jewish affair because all the people around him were Jewish. So it was very, very important to Jung it was very, very important to Freud that Jung come aboard because he was a psychiatrist and many of the other people were not. And he was in a position, he had a psychiatric reputation that was quite strong because of his work at the Berkholtzli and his studies on the association experiment, which gave him international fame. In fact, greater fame than Jung had. I get these names mixed up when I talk excitedly like now. Than Freud had. Jung had actually the greater reputation in psychiatry. And so it was very interesting to Freud to have him aboard. But it was especially interesting to have a non-Jew aboard for just the reason I said. So the people around Jung called him the blonde Siegfried. And there was commentary about this tall, blonde Swiss-German man that Freud was so obviously enamored of. So there was a lot of envy, and you get a situation a little bit like Joseph and his brothers, where they were just eager to throw him in the pit. and that eventually happened when Jung began to disagree with Freud so vehemently that there was a break between them. And then Carl Abraham took over as the man who carried psychoanalysis forward in the most loyal way, helped yeah. found the first psych institutes.
That's fascinating. I felt like the film failed to communicate the charisma of either Jung or Freud, even though I read that Viggo Mortensen as Freud and Michael Fassbender as Jung were chosen because they had those qualities. But somehow both men are reported to have been very charismatic in their time.
Well, usually the characters in a Cronenberg film are rather cold, creepy people, and there's a certain clamminess to them. And it's a very much a Cronenberg stylistic thing. Cronenberg's a major figure in among film directors, but like many a cinema auteur, there's a distinctive style, and the Cronenberg style is a rather weirdly flat male who has some kind of inner life in reserve. And then an elaborate and rather grotesque fantasy world into which this hero falls, in which all kinds of dark things emerge, usually from outside himself. In the film, Viggo Mortensen is represented as a rather worldly, cynical man who looks and comments on the human condition in a rather wry way. And what you see there is what I would call a kind of worldly, somewhat earthy, extroverted sensation that just looks at the human condition as it is. It's a little bit like the worldly tone of some of the interpretation of dreams, but it completely omits the enormous hidden gentlemanliness and grace that everyone commented on who knew Freud personally. And as far as Jung, he's this extremely timid, introverted thinking type, who's so correct and so clearly reserved in his feeling nature. And he has this rather sweet, kind, extroverted feeling wife who's trying to carry all the feeling for him. And I think that Jung certainly had a lot of feeling development to do between 1904 and 1920, but I don't think he, and some of his pictures show a somewhat military posture, but people who were around him speak of his booming laughter at that time. Lou Andreas Salome describes how he had that booming laughter at the first psychoanalytic congress she attended in 1911, and it just isn't the Jung here is much more timid than it's really Cronenberg's construction of these two men.
And I shouldn't slight Keira Knightley. What's your impression of her portrayal of Sabina?
Well, there I do feel we have something that as a student of film makes sense to me, but as an everyday lover of going to the movies, most people are likely not only to miss, but also not to like. And if you're used to a certain kind of cinema acting, Keira Knightley's performance is something of a disappointment. If you are used to the kind of cold film that makes you contemplate certain psychological complexes of the type that David Cronenberg and people like David Lynch make, then Keira Knightley's performance makes more sense. What I said yesterday, or was it Sunday at the conference, is that Cronenberg is a very transgressive director. And when I work with directors whose work is a little bit odd or peculiar, I have to ask myself, what is the creative personality that has made this particular film? That is to say, what is the complex out of which the film is generated? For instance, if you're thinking about Alfred Hitchcock, it's very obvious that Hitchcock comes out of the archetype of the trickster, And the classic thing a trickster does is to put you in a double bind. And we experience a double bind when we watch one of Hitchcock's films. We call it suspense.
That's great.
We both know that something terrible is going to happen, and we want something terrible to happen because it's getting to be so exciting. We can barely stand the suspense. And so that's all because Hitchcock is channeling his work through the archetype of trickster. Now, when we get to Cronenberg, whose films are really quite off-putting for many, many people, I mean, he's been described, I have a note here that I just, as the king of venereal horror or the baron of blood. I mean, his work involves some of the nastiest stuff, like Dead Ringers, where the two twin obstetricians, one of whom is a paranoid psychotic, are doing various examinations on gynecological patients who don't know which brother is working on them at a particular time, and conducts the examination with sadistic instruments of examination that have been invented by the psychotic brother. I mean, you can't imagine a more horrific scenario. Jeremy Irons plays both brothers in a very cold, creepy performance. So what you get from a David Cronenberg film involves an archetype that I've had to name for myself, because we don't have a name for it in Jungian psychology yet, so I added it in. And I call it the archetype of the opposing personality. By that I mean that his films are extremely oppositional. And the characteristics of the opposing personality are that they are, it has four faces. One is that it is seductive, one that it is paranoid, one that it is avoidant, and one is it's passive-aggressive. And a David Cronenberg film is all those things. And so you have all kinds of peculiar sensations of being put off while you watch those films. Now, what I think is interesting is that this figure often is symbolized in the dreams of people by a figure of the opposite sex, and occasionally this figure will appear on the screen. Now, Hitchcock's movie about the opposing personality is his famous film Marnie, and critics felt about Tippi Hedren's performance in Marnie quite as they felt as they felt about Keira Knightley's performance. That this woman is somehow cold and off-putting, and they didn't like it. They were looking for an anima figure, and the opposing personality is not the anima. She is not someone who makes you fall in love with her. She's actually someone who pushes you away. People felt Tippi Hedren, people would say, God, her hair looks like metal. Ooh, she's so cold. She can't act. And they were saying about Keira Knightley, she overacts. Well, yes, her first scene is she's sticking her tongue out. She's making these jutting jaw movements. Her first statement to Jung when he comes into this is, I'm Dr. Jung, and she says, I'm not mad, you know. She becomes the very image of the opposing personality that's been the creative source of so many of Cronenberg's films. And Cronenberg was delighted with her performance, he says, in many interviews. And I think he was able, through her, to use a character to personify something that's important to him and that has some value. So we have the problem that the woman, the actual woman, Sabina Spielrein, is being used to express a complex in the creative autobiography of a cinema auteur. Now, it would be better if we had more women auteurs so that we could see women as they see themselves. For instance, I was pleased with The Iron Lady because the director is a woman, and she was able to show the emptiness of power and the need and the difficulty that simply attaining power has for the development of the feminine self extremely poignantly through the performance of Meryl Streep. Now, no one gives the director of that film much credit, and everyone gives Meryl Streep credit for what is surely one of the 10 greatest performances by a woman in film, all film. But the woman director was able to make a point that with great empathy that a male director really couldn't have made. And similarly, I think David Cronenberg burdens the historical Sabina with carrying the image of an opposing personality so that she becomes basically, from his rendering, an adolescent, oppositional, defiant girl with hysterical symptoms that are clearly her feminine protest against the patriarchal. But in a remarkable way, he shows the value of Sabina asserting herself against the male establishment. Now, the spanking, it seems to me, is some effort by Cronenberg to get his opposing personality under control. So maybe his opposing personality needed a spanking. But to say that, to make it seem as if somehow she needed to at least accept that much authority from Jung and then the authority of Jung's marriage and at the same time assert herself, leaves the film viewer in a very awkward position, particularly if they're a woman, to say, what do these men think we are like and what do these men think we need from our doctors? But nevertheless, despite all that, there is in Keira Knightley's performance an assertion of exactly what Sabina Spielrein was talking about when she talked about destruction as a source of coming into being. And you do get the feeling that Sabina comes into selfhood. Now, tragically, that's also a construction because Sabina Spielrein decided to go back to Russia after unsuccessful attempts to establish herself as a psychoanalyst in Europe, including a brief period where she analyzed Jean Piaget, who experienced her as simply trying to give him a propaganda education in psychoanalysis. So he didn't feel that it was therapy or instruction, and he never was convinced. And she finally terminated that relationship because it couldn't be because he wouldn't agree to the theory by which he was being analyzed. So that was a complete bust. She decides she's now married. She goes back to Russia and she tries to found a psychoanalytic nursery. It's in another film about Sabina called The Soul Keeper. This is called The White Nursery. It was a place where children were treated with psychoanalytic means and. Unfortunately, it was shut down by Stalin after just a few years. So after that, Sabina really begins to fade from history. And at our panel on Sunday, this last Sunday, Virginia Rutter very movingly said that she can't feel that there was that spark of inner life in Sabina after she stays in Russia and tries to work in a Soviet regime extremely hostile to psychoanalysis. Sabina's brother succeeds in becoming the founder of industrial psychology in Russia, but Sabina gets a chance to get herself and her child out of the children out of Russia before the Nazis come in 1941, and she doesn't take it, and so she ends up dying at the hands of a firing squad. Extremely during the siege of Leningrad. So this is a very, very painful story. And there is that feeling that she certainly doesn't get the vitality we see in Keira Knightley at the end of A Dangerous Method. And there really is the feeling on the part of at least one contemporary Jungian analyst, Virginia Rutter, which I and she owns it as her own feeling. She's only saying what she feels, not that she knows that this is the case, that a different kind of analytic experience could have enabled her to access the core of her own feminine vitality. So I think that Cronenberg's depiction coming out of his own complexes expresses finally the wish, the ideal, that there had been a true coming into being as a result of the analysis of the destructiveness. But certainly a spanking wasn't going to do it, whatever Cronenberg thought. Certainly an extramarital affair wasn't going to do it, whatever Sabina and possibly Jung thought. And Freud himself refused to accept her into treatment. And when she continued to talk about the fact that she still felt loving feelings for Jung despite being married and still had that longing for a child, Freud said, how can you possibly, and this is historical, he writes a letter to her, says, it just makes me sick when you talk about this Christian mythology, and we no longer, I don't have the same feeling about Jung that I had at the time that you started seeing him. I've become disenchanted with him, and can't you get it? We're Jews, and I hope your child grows up to be a good Jewish boy. And I hope he's an ardent Zionist, and these, in a sense, nobody fully, but perhaps in theory, Sabina herself took that striving for selfhood that was in her fantasy life and in her crush on Jung and her wish for a Siegfried and her wish to be a psychoanalyst and her wish to get treatment first from Jung and then from Freud. Nobody took her as seriously as I hope we would take a feminine self striving in its own symbolic way to realize itself, perhaps with aggression and opposition along the way. I hope that today we would take a feminine self like that far more seriously. And for that, I think we owe Sabina Spielrein and her story an enormous thanks. And we owe Cronenberg some thanks that he at least gets the point of the opposition to the patriarchal that was coming out of Sabina. I think he gets the point in a poetic way.
This has given me a lot more points of view in my audience to think about Sabina, both the real Sabina and the way that she's portrayed in the film. Before we run out of time, though, I want to get your take on Otto Gross, whom I was not aware of, and in the film he's this almost demonic kind of tempter. Tell us about Otto Gross.
Well, he was a very brilliant psychoanalyst, if he really was a psychoanalyst. He was a psychiatrist. We owe to him, those of people who are interested in typology, he wrote a paper in which he talked about the second cerebral function, and it's a complicated matter, but Jung's idea of an auxiliary function to our typology, in my own case, as you may have gathered, I'm an extroverted intuitive, but I have an auxiliary introverted thinking. The idea of the auxiliary function is really an Otto Gross idea. Now, unfortunately, some people think Otto Gross also gave Jung the idea of introversion, extroversion, and I'm afraid Jung didn't steal that from Otto Gross, though he may have from Alfred Binet. So it's not a question of priority about introversion, extroversion. And Jung does pay Gross tribute in Psychological Types. Gross was manic depressive, and he was hospitalized at the Berkholzeli. And at the time, he was in a, you might call it a common law marriage, a liaison with a woman named Frida. And they were at the artist community of Ascona, which had many early dance therapists, the famous and the beginning of what we nowadays call movement therapy with a man named Laban. And this is the kind of world that Isadora Duncan, rather bohemian and dance and artist, and it was also a free love community. And Frida and Otto Gross were both advocating free love, rather the way the characters in the movie Red, Reds, played by Warren Beatty and Diane Keaton, John Reed and his wife were advocating free love. Many people were doing that in the first decade of the 20th century. It was, and so Otto Gross comes under Jung's care at the Berkholzli, and he's portrayed in this film as a very tricksterish, extroverted intuitive who's bringing all kinds of new ideas to Jung. And Jung does go to Ascona eventually and gets and meets some of the people there. And but he definitely admits that Gross is a very brilliant and dangerous patient because his ideas are seductive. And Gross gives Jung the idea that there's no reason for monogamy and that polygamy is a good idea. And so for a brief period, Jung really starts thinking about polygamy. And when he and Spielrein are meeting and talking about what she calls their poetry, Jung says, well, a man doesn't have to be monogamous. One can be polygamous. So he's certainly admitting the possibility of an extramarital liaison. So this is probably very stimulating to Spielrein and rather dangerous to Jung's own marriage. One feels that Jung had a period where he really wondered out loud whether it was necessary to be monogamous, and he seems to have reeled himself back from that. He eventually was able to get a stable affair and one marriage, and as far as we can tell, there were only two women in Jung's life for about 20 years, and then finally he has a heart attack, and the doctors say that he can only have one visitor, and he has to choose between the women, and the one visitor that's allowed is his wife, and the other woman, Tony, will not speak to him for several months. And then when she tries to get back into his life, Jung doesn't want to get back into her life. So finally, he's with Emma and Emma only, and he never wanted to divorce Emma, but he did have quite a struggle in those early years with that polygamous idea, and it seems to have been planted in him by Gross. So Gross brings up the question of psychic infection, and he's sort of the mischievous imp who's sort of the person egging everyone on in this rather outrageous story in the movie. I think Otto Gross did have some effect on him. He eventually sadly, committed suicide. He was a cocaine addict, and I think there were other drugs as well. He had a real addiction problem, and that's what he was under treatment for. The Frida, whom he was with, went on to become D.H. Lawrence's wife, Frida Lawrence, and she was of course terribly stimulating also to D.H. Lawrence, who then became an advocate of sexual freedom as well in his writings, as we know, in the famous case of Lady Chatterley's Lover and the material in Women in Love and so forth. So we're talking about a time when new ideas were extremely charged, and we were in the beginning of the psychoanalytic revolution, the beginning of the sexual revolution, the beginning of the feminist revolution. I mean, this was a very charged time. And I do think some of that comes across in the movie, but I have to say, more tamely than I would have wished. It was a much more exciting and charged time than you can believe. This is a very safe, in some ways, genteel depiction of the lid flying off of a volcano which erupted all through the 20th century that involved sex and aggression and spirituality, and we're still sort of trying to figure out what we're doing with the fallout of all that even today.
Yes, we certainly are. Well, John, you've added so much dimensionality to this film and given us so much to think about. And I don't want to hold you any longer than I had suggested that when we talked earlier. So as we wind down here, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Well, one thing I would say is that Siegfried as an image didn't start with Sabine Spielrein. I told you it was around. The idea of the hero didn't either. The myth of the birth of the hero was a book by Otto Rank, and I really feel that that came out in, as I recall, 1909 or 1910, and really the idea of the hero was all over Europe at this time, and so everyone was trying to be their own personal hero, and perhaps the shadow side of that was a lack of humility. And the main thing I would advise all of us, it's easy to look down on these brave and courageous pioneers. That's what Peter Carnahan from the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, it's easy to say what they should have done, what they didn't do, what they missed. It's easy to see that they didn't have certain technical understanding and certain limits and certain ethics that we would now take very much for granted and insist on training. But what they did have was a sense of creative exploration. So they were all heroes, and they all had the fate of heroes, which is to overreach and then have to pay for their overreaching. But these are admirable people trying to create, and I have a lot of respect for every one of the people depicted in the film. And I have respect for David Cronenberg for attempting with ambition something of this size. So I think we owe the film, with whatever its limitations, a certain gratitude and a certain respect. And we owe these people and these pioneers respect. We wouldn't be talking to each other today had it not been for them.
Well, that's a great wrap-up. And you and I have yet to meet in person. I thought we would last Sunday, but then I wasn't able to attend. However, I see that you're going to be one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in Berkeley in June, and I'm planning to be there conducting interviews and attending workshops. So I look forward to, maybe we'll meet then.
Meeting in person. I'm really looking forward to it.
Dr. John Beebe, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. Well, it would be hard to polish that apple. I learned a lot about the early days of analysis, as well as about the David Cronenberg film. Dr. John Beebe is so knowledgeable and has researched this topic so deeply that I'll not attempt to add anything here, especially since we've also run a bit long. I will remind you to check out my Psychology Today blog post about the film. Just Google The Happiness Dispatch, and then look for the title of the post, which is A Dangerous Film? Also, you might be interested in a film about Sabine Spielrein's life, which you can get on Netflix. It's titled My Name Was Sabine Spielrein, and I think it's a useful background piece for the Cronenberg film. I mentioned the upcoming Association for the Study of Dreams conference, and Dr. John Beebe will be presenting there on June 26th from 9:15 to 10:15 in the morning on A Typology of the Shadow in Dreams. You can get more information about the conference at www.asdreams.org.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
You've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while now. You've been entertained, thought-provoked, inspired. And you've donated how many times? thought so. Wouldn't you like to make a change? To give just a little for all you receive? It's easy. Just hit the big green button on the website to keep Dr. Dave on the airwaves. Shrink Wrap Radio, proudly brought to you by you.
How about that? Big thanks for that excellent donation pitch from Claire Mackey and her business partner Andrew at Red Rug Productions in Lilyfield, Australia. Obviously, they are professionals, and if you need any such advertising or voiceover work, you should definitely seek them out. I hope their polished execution won't scare others of you off from submitting your own versions of a pitch for support for Shrink Wrap Radio. They've set the bar high, but it will be fun to see what other creative approaches might come forward, and it's definitely one of the ways you can help to support the effort here. I want to thank all of you who've clicked on that big green donate button, and it's been a while since I publicly thanked ultra-colossal donor John Holmstead and super-colossal donors Katie Morrison and Peter Myron. I just got back from a 3-day trip up the coast to the picturesque town of Mendocino with my adult son, Jonathan. We both needed a break, and we had a great time together. But after only 3 days away, I am so behind. That's why I'm getting this out a little later than I'd planned. So I'll try to keep this short so I can get it out today. First of all, there's a new interview at wisecounselpodcast.com, and it's with Dr. Peter Flom, who suffers from a rare learning disability known as NLD, which stands for Nonverbal Learning Disability. When he was 5, a psychologist told his parents he would never go to college. Well, Peter got his BA at 20, and now he has 2 master's degrees and a PhD in psychometrics. He relates that a lot of people think nonverbal learning disorder means that people with the diagnosis are nonverbal. But actually, it's a disability with the nonverbal aspects of language, like tone of voice, body language, facial expression, things like that, missing. You can learn more about this rare learning disability by listening to our interview at wisecounselpodcast.com. I don't recall if I already announced that there is now a transcript on our site for my interview on fairy tales with Jungian Dr. Thomas Eisner. I think I did announce that, but I'm not sure. Speaking of Jungian, don't forget that there are now 4 CE courses on Jungian psychology on our site for a total of 26 units. If you take all 4, you can earn a special certificate of completion. You can find more info and links on the store tab on our site. Now, on with the show.
Hi, this is Robert Haas, author, dream researcher, and instructor. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Robert Haas, who will be my return guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to just a couple of emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Mike, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm writing to you to illuminate an innovator in the field of peak performance who travels and composes material of deep emotional and spiritual insight. The gentleman's name is Gary Malkin. Gary is a numerous Emmy Award-winning musical composer of the motion picture industry for more than 15 years. He recently had a series of dramatic, life-changing events and has found a renewed sense of mission in life to bring peak states of emotional and spiritual capacity to the worldwide community. Gary wrote the musical score to the amazing documentary Thrive, and composed the music for the hit television series Unsolved Mysteries. Gary is looking to partner with media outlets and promote an organic development of the notion of abundance from both top-down and bottom-up dynamics. I enclosed a bit of his bio and life's work. He's working a lot with the hospice movement. Is there a chance he could be featured on one of your podcasts? Could he reach out to you also? Would you mind if I started a thread on this topic, peak human potential, through the media on the Shrink Wrap news group on Yahoo? Much thanks, Dr. Dave, and I'm so happy to be a monthly supporter of the podcast." And that's from Mike. And Mike, you certainly can start that discussion thread on our Yahoo discussion group. And thank you for the recommendation of Gary Malkin. Mike included a lot of links, which I can't repeat here, but all you need to do is do a Google search on Gary Malkin, which is spelled M-A-L-K-I-N, and I will keep him in mind as a possible guest. Mike referenced the film Happy, saying that this fellow strikes a similar note. So it sounds like he would be a great guest. Now here's one from Claire, who submitted the promo that you heard earlier. Dear Dr. Dave, I'm responding to your, quotes, call to arms and putting my professional voiceover skills to good use. My generous business partner, Andrew, contributed his engineering skills, and we made a promo to play on your show. I hope that it nudges a few more listeners in the direction of that big green button. All the best, Claire. So, Claire, thanks again, and I also hope it nudges some folks in that direction. And here's one last one from Joe in Australia, who's been a longtime transcriber and supporter of this podcast in many ways. And she writes, "Hi, David. As a matter of fact, I'm listening to your latest Shrink Wrap Radio interview right now. The topic of positive psychology and health outcomes is very timely for me, as my partner, Michael, is presently going through a most grueling cancer treatment, with good news being a rare commodity as his situation has unfolded. Having said that, he's responding very well to the onerous treatments, which improves his prognosis considerably. As you would expect, I've been very busy and very challenged in many ways lately, and so I've had little spare time for my beloved podcast, but have kept up with all of your work and just one or two others of my hundreds of subscriptions." Wow, hundreds. "I really appreciate the range of high-quality material you provide to your listeners. Personally, I find gems of wisdom in each episode. By the way, I found a review today of the book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain, and I thought, oh, I must mention this author to David. What a wonderful guest Richard Davidson would make, and he seems so familiar somehow. Then I realized that, of course, you had already interviewed him. One of my favorite episodes, actually. I do hope there's something in that book about memory improvement. At least I remembered to use your link for the book depository, so a few more pennies will come your way eventually. Best regards from Joe." And Joe, I'm really sorry to hear that your partner Michael is so challenged by cancer. And I want listeners to know that I did have Joe's permission to share that email with you all. So you two hang in there, keep your chin up, and I'm glad that you continue to find value in these podcasts. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemail, which I haven't had in a long time, at 206-337-0622, or you can use our iPhone or Android app to do that. Thanks to Jungian analyst Dr. John Beebe for sharing his insights into the David Cronenberg film, A Dangerous Method. And as mentioned earlier, my next interview will feature a return visit by Robert Haas, and we'll be discussing the neuropsychology of dreaming. He's also chairing the upcoming 29th International Association for the Study of Dreams conference that's coming up this June in Berkeley, and he'll give us a bit of detail about that. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.